This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday the 30th of July. Welcome to the best of The Informer. This week we are showcasing the best journalism from your nightly news and current affairs show so far for 2018. I'm your host, Rachel Tyler-Jones. Tonight on the show, Tom Morgan looked into fertility preservation amongst trans and non-binary Australians, and Dean Arcuri and I spoke to Victoria Police about how they can better serve the LGBTI communities.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Tom Morgan spoke with Dr. Damien Riggs, Associate Professor in Social Work at Flinders University and Project Leader in the Research into Fertility Preservation amongst Trans and Non-Binary Australians. Dr. Riggs is a psychotherapist who works with transgender adolescents and children, and we discussed his experiences engaging with transgender young people about their fertility options, as well as their experiences and concerns.
In addition to working at Flinders, I'm a psychotherapist and I work with transgender kids. And so part of the conversations I have with children as they approach puberty and may wish to start puberty blockers is about fertility preservation. And it's an unusual conversation to have because you don't normally talk to very young children about do you want to have kids when you grow up, but it's part of what we need to do to make sure they have that option. Historically, trans people were expected to undergo a range of surgeries that would mean they could no longer conceive children from their own gamete. And that was the norm. That was what was expected. And there was no choice around that. And I think as that has shifted, as you know, and certainly only in the last decade, the possibility of storing gametes has been more widely available to trans people in Australia. But then people need to know that's available to ask for that service, unless they happen to work with a really inclusive service provider who says, oh, this is something you might like to think about. And that was, in a way, one of my entry points to this study, was knowing that as a clinician, I need to talk to young people about this, and I absolutely do that and believe in that. But worrying or wondering about what it means to say to a very young person before they start puberty blockers, do you want to store gametes, or for people who haven't started puberty, tissue, and in the possibility you might want kids in the future? And lots of people will say yes because you're offering a possibility, and who knows what you want in the future. But my worry is about the cost. It costs a lot of money to do this. It's invasive, particularly for trans boys and for trans men. There's annual storage fees. And then, of course, we know that the longer you freeze gametes, the less likely they are to thaw successfully. So I'm, you know, always being careful about that this is a possibility you could undertake, but there's no promise that even something will come of it, even if you decide you want to. So that was my initial entry point, actually, into this project, was wanting to know how many people are wanting to do this so that we can make sure people are informed about the decisions they're making down the track.
While discussing the initial findings of their research into fertility preservation decision-making amongst trans and non-binary Australians, it seemed clear that for Dr. Damien Riggs, co-lead researcher of this study at Flinders University, this was not just about understanding the number of individuals who had engaged with fertility preservation information and services, but also to identify the ways in which individuals have been limited in their access. I asked Dr. Riggs if it appeared that the majority had been made aware of these options available to them, specifically by medical and fertility professionals.
That was something that we were really, I guess, in a way surprised by. Not that we thought everyone would know it was an option, but, you know, as a clinician myself, and I work according to the WPATH standards, which say we need to advise people this is an option, we need to create those pathways. I think I just thought that most people would have come in contact because of the way gender transition is regulated in this country through medical professionals and mental health professionals, that people would have been exposed to this information. But I think partly it's probably a lack of professionals providing that information, and partly it's people saying, I don't want to be part of that system. I'm going to negotiate my own ways through gender transition, which may or may not involve hormones, may or may not involve surgery. And therefore, if you're not coming into contact with those professionals, you're not going to get the information. So that, I think, reflects a lot of research on not primarily on the lives of transgender people around having kids, that we tend to see much lower rates of trans people having kids than we would expect from a population average. And there's lots of reasons around that. People prioritise transition over having children, which is totally reasonable. People don't see children as part of their life. They have other areas that they focus on in their life. No one's really looked into, actually, why people are less likely to have kids if they're trans or non-binary, but it's a common research finding that far fewer people do have children. So we had about a third of participants were men and about a third of participants were non-binary, and then the rest was distributed between mainly women and then a small number of agender people. So we had a decent spread of diversity across our sample. Something I'll have to think about when we go back and write this second paper from the data is maybe look at, for people who had said they wish they had or would have liked that to have been an option, was there reasoning around cost? Because we don't really have that data, and I don't think we really have that data internationally. We have data that says the cost is prohibitive, but we don't necessarily know whether people would have done it even if the cost wasn't prohibitive. So we're sort of operating on what seems to be the case, that lower numbers of people are wanting to do this than you would expect from the general population. But maybe cost is a really key factor in the whole thing.
I also discussed with Dr. Riggs what, beyond the issue of cost and interest in biological children, could be done to improve the experiences and outcomes for trans and non-binary Australians to engage with fertility services and options going forward.
I think there's a knowledge, perhaps, limitation, and we're going to do another separate different study later, that's starting later this year, that's part of an international study. And part of that, it's primarily on trans men and reproduction, but we're also going to talk to reproductive health professionals. And what do they know about working with trans people in reproductive areas? What do they understand? What kind of inclusion do they offer? What kind of language do they use? So I think certainly the clinical capacity there is in terms of, you know, the practices, the techniques, but whether people would go along to those services and feel welcomed and feel included, that's another question. It is a slow burn, I think, and it should be a slow burn, because we have to prove we can be trusted if we're not transgender, and I'm not. We have to show that the research we do is fair and reasonable and inclusive. It doesn't contribute to anti-trans and anti-non-binary sentiment, and I think it takes time to trust people. And I think, you know, researchers and clinicians have done a lot of crappy things to trans and non-binary communities in the past and still in the present, and so I think it's really reasonable that over time we have built up trust as a research team, and that our research is seen as useful and trustworthy. And I think that's certainly our agenda, is to keep building that trust and to keep researching topics that people tell us are interesting and that they want to know more about, and not be led by random ideas we might have on what could be a useful topic. There's absolutely three prongs to it to us. There's one is community information, so that people know this is an option. There's one is about educating professionals so that they're aware of barriers. And the third is about, under the current WPATH standards, we're encouraged to suggest this to people, like give people advice, but it's a very brief couple of pages in a very long document. There's a new version hopefully coming out in the next year or so. Hopefully this will also inform that around how do we have these conversations, rather than just you should have the conversations with clients. How do we talk about it? Do we use a desire for genetic relatedness to be a way we have the conversation? Do we acknowledge that non-binary people have very specific experiences and needs? So it's also about informing that clinical work as well.
That was Tom Morgan speaking with Dr. Damien Riggs.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
In May, Victoria Police published the findings of a report into police and young LGBTI people's perceptions of one another. Dean Arcuri and I sat with Priority Communities Division Commander Stuart Bateson and unpacked the findings of the report, exploring how Victoria Police can meet the needs of our LGBTI communities as well as build greater awareness within the force. Victoria Police has launched a report that provides insight into police and young LGBTI people's perceptions of one another. Can you tell us what prompted this research in the first place?
Well, I think it's important. You know, we've been doing a lot of work with the LGBTI community over a number of years to try and build trust. You know, some our relationship has been strained over the years, but it was worthy to check in and just see how we were going. And we wanted to do that particularly with young people. Unfortunately for us, I guess it's brought back some really alarming results, not least of which is that 94% of the people surveyed said they had experienced some sort of abuse in their lifetime. And we're talking about young people between the ages of 16 and 25.
So how exactly did you go about getting the results?
So almost 80 young Victorians aged 16 to 25 participated in the online survey. Then we actually held a number of focus groups and interviews that took place across two regional Victorian sites. We also, as part of that survey, interviewed 360 officers. They actually responded to a survey rather than interviewed.
So it was on both sides of the coin?
Both sides of the coin. And what we found from the police point of view is that many of our officers lacked confidence. They were unsure how to communicate confidently with people from the LGBTI community. So that was an important learning for us as well.
Just roughly, what were the key findings? You've mentioned two of them, but if we just break it down for our listeners, what were the key findings that you found in the results?
So almost 60% of our frontline staff said they had received no training on LGBTI issues, and about 80% said they'd never consulted a GLO. So that was very problematic for us. However, 42% of the young people surveyed said that they would not be confident in going to police to report victimisations. They said that confidence increased when they actually dealt with a GLO. So our GLO program's really important. We've extended that to 260 officers across the state, but we need to support those officers to be more confident and to use them to train and provide information to our frontline staff as well.
Could you maybe just tease that out for us a little bit and tell us what GLO stands for and what it takes to become a GLO officer?
So GLO has become more of a brand than anything else, but it's our LGBTI liaison officer network. So we've started those back in the early 2000s, and really it's just a person that is able to confidently interact, and people from the LGBTI community can know, well, yes, they understand my issues and they'll be able to help me. And that's an important part for that.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9, and we're speaking to Commander Stuart Bateson from Victoria Police. One of the really interesting things is the fact that 60% of your frontline staff hadn't consulted a GLO and didn't know what to do in these scenarios, because the GLO is an absolutely brilliant initiative. We're very familiar with it here at Joy. We see them a lot when we're, you know, the GLOs are out at festivals, they're out at LGBTI venues. But kind of when you look at that research and realise that internally people aren't reaching out to GLOs, so it maybe, was that result what you were expecting?
No, that was surprising to us, and I think that really showed somewhere where we can improve, because our GLOs have been, as you said, really good at reaching out to the community and being visible and present and building trust with community, but they haven't necessarily looked inwards and seen how they could help, and nor have we actually pushed them into that space. So I think now that we've sort of got this result, we can say, hey, how can we actually build that relationship, not only between the GLOs and the community, but the GLOs and other police? And that's certainly going to be a focus for us over the next few years.
So when you were all looking at these results and seeing what they were these the results that you were expecting from something like this?
Look, I guess It surprised me in particular that only, you know, just under half of young people said they'd report victimisation to us, that they would trust us enough to do that. I would have thought that would be higher. So, yes, that did surprise me. But when I talked to community members, it was no surprise to them. So I think that's the importance of doing research like this, to make sure that we understand the issues of the community and then respond to them. Because we perhaps thought we were doing a little bit better than that, and it shows we've got some real work in front of us.
Do you think that some of that hesitance to come forward is actually because the prejudice-motivated crime that they're talking about or considering in those situations is almost thought to be too everyday or too minor to be to report?
Look, perhaps, but it was also a really interesting finding that they didn't think that Victoria Police views, even though they didn't feel that they could always trust them, differed too much more than their general community. So that was an interesting thing as well. So not only have we got work to do within Victoria Police, I think it's an issue that the community need to grapple with as well, and just how important it is for young people from the LGBTI community to feel that they're valued. And I think that's the importance of being able to report victimisation, that when they come forward, their story will be respected and it will be valued for what it is.
In regards to the survey and in regards to the findings and what we're talking about now, what exactly do you quantify as victimisation?
Well, it's interesting. That wasn't clearly spelt out in the survey in the question, so it was left to the definition of the person answering the survey. So, you know, I think victimisation is different for different people. But from my perspective, if you feel like you're being victimised, then that's real enough, and that's damaging enough. And, you know, even if it may well be harassment that falls short of breaking the law, we want that information, because we know that, you know, homophobic and transphobic commentary can often be a precursor to violence. So that kind of intelligence help us to deliver, you know, increased patrols in areas where it's happening.
You're on The Informer on Joy 94.9, and we're speaking with Commander Stuart Bateson from Victoria Police. So I guess now the next step is to figure out a way to get that message out to the community. So what steps are Victoria Police planning or thinking about taking after looking at these results to improve your relationship with young LGBTI people?
So the recommendations within the report are pretty clear. So there's talk around leadership, and I think that's a really important part within Victoria Police that we're really working towards. So it's about making sure that our senior leaders and our police station commanders understand the importance of being visible and available, and understanding and listening to the experiences of young people from the LGBTI community. There's also a little bit about expanding our GLOW network and making sure that they're much more visible and involved in community events. And there's also a little bit about training, you know, giving our frontline members the confidence to interact with the community. And that's certainly going to be where we concentrate our efforts over the next 12 months.
It kind of sounds like a whole rounding approach. Like, really, when you break it down that way, it does really sound like on every single side of this issue, we really need to do some work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's also work that needs to happen in the community. This is not just a policing issue. It's really about the community come to grips. And, you know, it's interesting. I did some media last week, and some of the commentary and the feedback coming back on social media, I think, really speaks to, you know, the victimisation that some of these young people from the community had suffered over time, and really calls out that this is an issue that's bigger than the police, and something that I think we need leaders right across the community to step up and say enough. We're just not going to stand for it anymore.
Going back to what you were talking about with some of these maybe more minor crimes or the harassment that's maybe not yet a criminal offence, could you just talk us through how you would go about reporting a prejudice-motivated crime and what happens when you do?
So a prejudice-motivated crime is any crime that's motivated by prejudice. So it might be an assault, it might be a criminal damage, And when we actually see that that's been motivated by hate or by prejudice, that allows us to charge on that extra category, and it also involves further sentencing options for the magistrate or judge. So that's an important part to call out. But, you know, also, as I said, you know, when it falls short of a criminal offence, but it's still homophobic, it's still transphobic, and it's still hateful, that's the kind of information that we need. And this is where I say to the community, we need that information reported into our GLOWs, because if it's happening regularly in certain places, then we need to step up our patrols and put a stop to it.
On a very practical level, how would you go about getting that information to the GLOWs?
So ring them is probably the best, and we've got a list of our GLOWs on our website, so that would probably be the best case scenario, or go in and see them in the police stations. I should also say that one of the more effective ways, if you want to remain anonymous, is to call Crime Stoppers, and they'll record that information for us.
I guess as I'm listening to this, I guess one of the things, and one of the interesting things is really, I'm still coming back to the frontline staff and how they felt in regard to this scenario. If we're creating a space, even though you are working on improving and the breadth of the GLOW program and what that means for our community, if we're creating a space where go to a GLOW instead of going to any other police officer, are you concerned about what that message might mean for further disenfranchising within both the police force and the community?
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. And, you know, we hope we're not in that position in another 6 or 12 months. But, you know, if we've got people that are experiencing that kind of homophobic, transphobic commentary, the best persons to go to at this point is GLOWs. And hopefully in 12 months, 18 months, you could go to any police officer and they would say, yes, I know that's not a crime, but I'm going to take some action anyway.
I know what to look for the GLOWs. I know what the abbreviation is. But for someone else in our community, being able to just search online and find where that is isn't necessarily something that's as easy to do. Is there a possible steps to be able to create better avenues for people to access the information so they can contact the GLOWs?
Absolutely. And you know, one of the other recommendations from the report was, you know, how can we develop other methods of reporting, and that's something that we've got to look at, where people can remain anonymous and report those minor infringements or offensive commentary. So that's a challenge for us too, but at this point in time, that the GLOWs are the best contact. But we do have to make them more visible. But if you go to the website, you'll find a list of them.
This isn't the results that anyone was expecting. There's been a lot of work that's been done. There's been a lot of work on many levels. But of course, suddenly when we look at these results, it kind of confirms what perhaps a lot of young people have been saying. So there is work that we have to do on every side of this. But what is the main thing that you would like to let the LGBTI community of Victoria know so that we can start to kind of build these bridges and work towards a better communication?
Well, I think the most important thing is that your experience, and if you are a victim of crime, please report it. You know, we will take that report seriously and we will take action. And if you're not satisfied with the service you get from the police, you should be highlighting that to the local managers or through the complaint system. But I encourage you to speak to a GLOW and gain their trust and talk to them about those issues.
Thank you for joining us on The Informer, Commander Stuart Bateson from the Victoria Police.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Children with gender dysphoria no longer have to seek court approval to undergo surgery in Australia. It was decided by the family court that they will no longer intervene in cases where children with gender dysphoria have the permission of their parents and treating doctors to undergo surgery. Hilary Kincaid from the Inner City Legal Centre speaks to us now.
In November last year, the full court of the family court decided that it wasn't necessary in all cases for transgender young people to have to go to court before they could get estrogen or testosterone. And it had previously been mandatory regardless of if the parents were in support. And that meant that the law in this area about stage 3 treatment, which is surgical interventions, and in this case the type of treatment was top surgery, that meant that the law was a little bit uncertain. So we filed an application on behalf of some previous clients of ours who we've represented in an application for testosterone for their son in relation to top surgery. And we filed that late last year and it was heard last Wednesday. The court concluded that in circumstances like our client's case, and I'll use the anonymised name of Matthew, that's not the child's real name, it is not necessary to make an application to the court before stage 3 treatment can start. And those circumstances were both parents were in support. There was no disagreement between the treating medical practitioners about whether the child was competent to give his own consent or whether he should have the surgery. And there was medical evidence to show that the treatment was therapeutic. It's quite exciting, and the decision that came out on Friday builds on the logic of the full court's decision in Ree Kelvin, which is the case about stage 2 last year, and determines that because this treatment is therapeutic and because gender dysphoria is a recognised medical condition, there is no need for there to be a court application where there's no disagreement. This decision and the decision last year don't cover children who are in the care of the minister, so there may be future cases that deal with that issue. And I think that there is a recognition that the things that we say courts are for, which is to resolve disagreement, to resolve controversy by examining the evidence, that simply doesn't apply where everyone is in support. It may be that because a child is in the care of the minister that there's an argument that the court has more of a supervisory jurisdiction than when someone is in the care of their parents. But I think that the logic of these two decisions would certainly affect any future decisions of the family court. I wouldn't say that we've done ourselves out of a job just yet, but this certainly takes the majority of these cases out of the courts, which is the way that it should be. Where they don't necessarily have parental support, there have been cases. There's been two cases of older transgender children who are, I think, about 17. Two separate cases where they made an application to the court and the court gave them parental responsibility for themselves for the purposes of consenting to this treatment. That might be the form of the application. But if they have one parent who is in support and one parent who is not in support, then the process would probably be that the supportive parent would make an application to the family court for a declaration that this treatment could go ahead. So not so much in terms of the family court, but in New South Wales, if you are a child born in New South Wales and you want to change the record of your sex on your birth certificate, then current law is that you must have had a sex affirmation procedure, which is surgery affecting the reproductive organs. I think that is entirely barbaric and medieval. And one of the things that the ICLC is involved in is law reform in this area, pushing for a change to the New South Wales legislation. We've been practicing in this area for the last nearly 5 years, specifically with transgender young people, and it has been a real privilege to be able to work with these young people and their parents and to help them to live the lives that they want.
That was Principal Solicitor Hilary Kincaid from the Inner City Legal Centre.
That's it for tonight's episode of The Best of the Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Rachel Tyler-Jones.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.